two shiurim about Amir la'akum, and this is going to be our final shiur. So what we need to touch on today is what happens when you have a situation of Amir la'nafri, when you're asking a non-Jew to do some kind of activity for you, where it's a situation of what we refer to in halacha as a psik reshe. Those are Aramaic words. Psik reshe means, anybody knows what it means? The literal translation of the words are cutting off the head. Now, what does cutting off the head have any connection to what we're talking about? So the Gemara gives the following discussion, nothing to do with Amir al-Nafri, it has to do with a sidebar conversation, which we're then going to transfer into this discussion here. So the Gemara talks about the following scenario. The Gemara says that children back in the days of the Tanoim and Amoraim...
I was going to say, it was like cut the head off the chicken.
Yeah, so the Gemara says they didn't really have so many board games, and they didn't really have so many options of things to do on Shabbos, so what they used to do, generally, was they used to play with the head of a chicken. They used to throw the head of a chicken from one to the other, and that would be some kind of game. Sounds like a, if you ask me, a nauseating game to be playing, but it sounds like it was a lot of fun for them. But the problem is, what do you do on Shabbos? Here we have a long Shabbos afternoon, and we forgot to prepare the chicken head before Shabbos began. So the Gemara asks, what are you supposed to do? So the kids say, what's the big deal? We'll just cut off the head of the chicken now, and we'll play with it. What's the problem with doing that? What's the problem with doing that? Because killing an animal on Shabbos would not be permissible. That's the Tilas Neshama. You're not allowed to kill an animal. So you're certainly not allowed to kill the chicken, even if all you want is the head. But the kids say back, well, we're not really killing the animal. We don't care to kill the animal. If there was a way to play with the head without killing the animal, we would do that. Now, we turn back to the kids and we say, that sounds wonderful. It's a great argument, but it doesn't work because there is no way to get what you want without cutting off the chicken's head, and that means without killing it. So therefore, that's referred to in halacha as a psik reshe. When you do something, you don't want the unintended consequence, but there's no way to do what you want without that consequence happening. So that would not be permissible on Shabbos. And therefore, the Gemara says, say for example, if I have a dirt backyard, and I know that by pulling a chair, it is 100% going to make a charitz. How do you call that in English? A furrow is not the right word. It's going to make a, what?
A track,
right? It's going to make a track in the mud as I pull this bench or this chair through the mud. That would not be permissible on Shabbos. Even though all I want is to get the chair or the bench from place A to place B. It so happens that the only way to do that is by dragging it on the floor. It's too heavy for me to carry. Once I drag it on the floor, it is inevitably going to cause a track to be formed. It's going to cause the dirt to move around and move aside, which is not permissible on Shabbos. That's Choresh on Shabbos. But yet, that would not be permissible. Why is it not permissible? That's what we refer to as a psik reshe, because there is no way to do the action that you're trying to do without that consequence coming about. And if that consequence is a malacha on Shabbos, that would not be permissible. So over here, where you have a situation where Amir al-Nafri on Shabbos in general, I'm not allowed to ask a Gentile to do something for me on Shabbos. What about a situation where all I'm asking him to do is a psik reshe? Means I want him to do X. X is not a malacha. But I know that while he does that, a malacha is going to occur. What's the most common example? The most common example that comes up so often in our homes. Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses the following. What would he say? What's a great example of this? Asking a non-Jew to do something that is a psik reshe on Shabbos. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam shehakol nehi avid baram. So you forget to turn off the refrigerator light before Shabbos. So then you're not able to open the door because every time you open it, you're going to activate that light. You're going to turn it on. May I have a Gentile open the door for me, or perhaps not? Rav Moshe says, yes. Why yes? Why yes?
Because it's like a space thing for a derech, it's like for the malacha.
Well, slow down. What are you saying? It's a svek sveka. Svek sveka means...
It's not actually, but...
It's not at all.
Two levels.
It's like not at all. It's not a svek sveka. Svek sveka means I'm not exactly sure whether or not this is going to happen. Here, I'm 100% sure that the light is going to go on. The last time I opened the door, the light went on. So I know it's going to go on. So would I be allowed to do this or not? What's the answer? So So Rav Moshe says, yes. Why? Based on what we just said. What am I asking the non-Jew to do? All I'm asking the Gentile to do is to open the door. Now it so happens the only way to open the door is to have the light turn on. But I don't really care whether the light goes on or not. So I'm not asking the non-Jew, please go and turn on the light of the refrigerator. All I'm asking the non-Jew to do is open the door. That's what we refer to as a psik reshe. And the Shulchan Aruch says, whenever you have a psik reshe, although for a Jew, it would not be permissible to do a malacha, to do any activity on Shabbos when you know that that unintended consequence is going to be the result of your action, when it comes to Amir al-Nahri, that would not be a problem. What you meant to say, I think, was, not svek sveka, it's the wrong term to use, I think what you meant to say was that this is like far removed from the action that they're doing, right? So there's like, number one, I'm asking a Gentile to do something which is permissible, and then as a result of something that they're doing, something else is going to happen. So that's basically what this concept of psik resha is. Or take for another example, if I have a Gentile in my home, and I want them to turn on the hot water, would I be allowed to ask them to turn on the hot water on Shabbos? So what would you say?
Depends what you're going to use it for.
Why should it depend what you're going to use it for?
Because if it's for psikresha, then you would be able to say yes based on Rav Moshe, but not.
Slow down. If it's for a psikresha, what does that mean if it's for a psikresha?
Meaning if there was some other purpose that you would need to have that faucet.
Let's say I want the hot water because I want to wash the dishes. So can I ask a non-Jew, can I ask a Gentile to turn on the hot water in my house on Shabbos? Yeah?
No, because that itself is a malacha, but if you ask them to wash the dishes, and they want them to...
No, so let's get to the washing dishes in a minute. If I ask them to wash the dishes, we'll get to that soon. What about, I'm asking them to turn on the hot water because I want to wash the dishes. Now, I'm not allowed to turn on the hot water because that's bishul. I'm cooking. Every time I turn on the hot water, it's ultimately going to cause other water to heat up. So the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa writes, in the name of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew to turn water on, to turn on the hot water on Shabbos. Why? Isn't that asking them to do an outright malacha for you? The answer is, he says, that's a psik reshe. What I'm asking them to do now is turn on the water. The water is already in the tank. It's in the reservoir. It's already heated up. Now it so happens that an unintended consequence, after you have the water running for a certain amount of time, more water is then going to enter the tank and heat up, and that is going to be causing a malacha to happen. And therefore, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, this would not be a problem. However, he says, what if you have a tankless, instant hot system in your home? How many of you have that at home? How many of you maybe don't know whether or not you have it? Right, you're not sure? Do you know what the difference is between... So generally, most sinks from at least 5 years ago and earlier are going to have a hot water tank where there's a certain amount of hot water, a certain number of gallons that are going to be heated in there, and it's never going to go lower than a certain amount. Once you empty out the tank to a certain level, it's automatically going to fill up again and start heating up water so that it can continuously flow with hot water. Right? You ever take a shower and then it gets cold? Why does it get cold? Because your tank is only able to be that size, only that big. At a certain point, it can't heat up the water quickly enough for you to use that much hot water. The new thing that they have now is that they have what's called a tankless water instant hot, a tankless water heater, which means that there's basically a mechanism where you have a coil, a burning hot coil, that the water touches that coil and immediately it heats up upon your turning it on. That happens right away. Now, this presents, it's really amazing. It's amazing because then you never run out of hot water, right? The coil is always there and it goes right away. But the problem with that is, number one, when it comes to this issue, you no longer have the heter of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Why? Because the moment you turn the water on, right, the moment the non-Jew will turn the water on, the malacha is being done. It's not something that's an unintended consequence that's going to happen later. This is exactly what you're intending to do. This is what's going to happen immediately when you turn on the faucet. And therefore, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach would say, in that case, that would be problematic. That would not be acceptable. That would not be okay. Am I making sense? A second place in halacha where that would be extremely relevant is, anybody know? So everybody knows that you're allowed to turn on the hot water on Yom Tov. Why? What? Because you're allowed to cook. So what's the problem? If I turn on the hot water, at worst what I'm doing is cooking. So what's the problem? That's not an issue at all. That works when you have a tank. What if you have one of these new systems, which is a tankless water heater? And immediately when you turn it on, it's an instant hot. And that means you're being molid eish mechadash, which means the coil is now turning on because of what I'm doing. On Yom Tov, you're allowed to cook, but you're not allowed to light a new flame. You're not allowed to create a new fire. So here, every time I turn on the hot water, I'm basically creating a new fire to heat up the water. The coil doesn't remain red hot. It only turns red hot when I turn on the flame, when I turn on the faucet. Am I making sense? So this would be a major, major problem when it comes to Yom Tov. And many people are not aware of that. So this is energy efficient, and that's why in many modern homes they have this system. And it's also very helpful that you're always going to have hot water. The problem is when it comes to Yom Tov, you have to think of some kind of creative solution to get around the problem. Yeah?
If the hot water is already in the tank, why can't you just turn on the hot water yourself? Like, isn't that kind of getting burned?
Again, I'm sorry. Isn't that kind
if
of what?
If the hot water is already in right. the tank, why can't you just turn on the hot water yourself? Like, isn't that the same thing as using an urn where you're just, like, the hot water is already there?
That's a good question. However, at a certain point, the hot water is going to empty out of the tank, and then it's going to refill.
So let's say you have a thing where it doesn't refill, then can you just do it
yourself? Sure. That's basically taking it out of an urn. Or, my father once told me that Rav Breuer, who was the Rav in Washington Heights for the German community, said, if you live in an apartment building and you have 20 floors, you know how big the tankless, the heater in the basement is going to be in order to provide hot water for the entire building? So when you turn on hot water in your apartment on Shabbos, when there's 20 floors of apartments that are also going to use water on Shabbos, the assumption is, I'm not going to be the one who's going to make the heater actually start doing melacha. That's like taking water out of an urn, and I'm making no dent at all to the process. Now, it's hard to say that, because at some point, someone's going to make the difference, and someone's going to make it happen. But there's room to say that if I'm in a large apartment building that has so many other people, and many of them non-Jews who are going to be using the water, that would be something that might be a mitigating factor for this as well. So that's a very valid point. Okay? Now let's move a little bit further. What about when you have a situation of Amira La'akum, where it can be performed in a permissible way? So the Shulchan Aruch says, if there's a way that this can be done in a permissible way, but for the non-Jews, for the Gentiles' own convenience, he or she is going to do it this way with a malacha, that would not be a problem at all. So what would be a great example? A great example would be, if I'm staying on the first floor of a hotel, right? One floor up. So I should say the second floor, right? You have the lobby, and you have floor two. So I'm staying in room 201, pretty close to the downstairs. In the middle of the night, I realize we're about to put the baby to sleep. They forgot to put a crib in my room. So what do? I go down to the lobby. I say, you forgot to bring a pack and plate in my room. Can somebody bring it up? Sure, no problem. How are they going to bring it up? Of course they're going to go in the elevator. That's what any normal person would do if they weren't worrying about Shabbos. Is there a permissible way for them to bring it to my room without an elevator? Yes, there is, conceivably. You could walk up one flight of steps and bring a pack and play up to the second floor and set it up. Not a big deal. So in that case, the Shulchan Aruch says, even if the Nachri decides to bring it up in the elevator, it wouldn't be a problem. Why? Because they have the option to bring it up by the stairs, which was no malacha at all. And therefore, if they chose to do a malacha, it would not be a problem at all. That's what the Shulchan Aruch refers to as adaita de nafshe. The non-Jew, the Gentile, decided to do this on his own. I didn't ask him to do this malacha for me. I asked him to bring me a pack and play. There was a very easy way for him to do it otherwise. There's an even easier way for him to do it using the elevator, but therefore we assume he's only doing it for his own convenience. He's not doing it for me. So that's why I gave that example, because everyone would agree that that's a very clear example. What happens, I remember many years ago, I was in the Plaza Hotel, Alav HaShalom, right, in Yerushalayim. It used to be the Plaza Hotel. What is it now? Anybody know? I guess you were all post-Plaza days. Whatever it's called. Very, very high floors. I think at the time we were staying on the 12th floor and somebody forgot to arrange for a crib in their room. So what did they do? They went down 12 flights of stairs, told the front desk, you forgot to set up a crib in our room, and assumed that, what's the big deal? If the non-Jew is going to bring it up 12 flights of steps, what's the big deal? Because it's adaita de nafshe. He's doing it on his own. It's just for his own convenience. Is that really true? Is he really doing it on his own convenience? No. No. So many say that that would not be acceptable. Again, this is a dispute. But many say that would not be acceptable. The Sefer Aruch HaShabbos, my father agrees as well. It has to be reasonable. That's unreasonable to assume that a Nachri is going to walk up 12 flights of steps holding a pack and play is an unreasonable expectation. It just doesn't make sense. Imagine the elevator was broken and you're going to have to wait an hour until they fix the elevator. The Nachri is not going to walk up 12 flights of steps with the pack and play while they're fixing the elevator. He'll just say, you have to wait an hour. The elevator's not working. Correct? I think that would be the case. But even if that wouldn't be the case, it's not reasonable to assume that a Nachri is going to walk up 12 flights of steps with a pack and play in his arms. And therefore, we would assume that that would not be called Adaita the Nafshe. He's not doing that for his own convenience. He's doing that clearly for you. This is nothing that he would ever think of doing otherwise in any other fashion. And therefore, we would assume that that potentially would be a problem on Shabbos. Take another very common example, and that is, what about washing dishes on Shabbos? Right, so what's the status of washing dishes? Am I allowed to ask a non-Jew to wash my dishes on Shabbos? What are the potential problems with washing dishes on Shabbos? Schita is one problem. Schita means you're not allowed to squeeze liquid out of a sponge on Shabbos, so that's problem number one. As I'm washing the dishes, obviously, I'm squeezing from the sponge all of the liquid that is inside of it. So that's problem number one. More fundamentally, the problem is turning on the hot water, right? Because turning on the hot water is something that is a malach on Shabbos. So, am I allowed to have a Nachri clean my dishes on Shabbos? The answer is yes. Why yes? Why yes?
Because
theoretically, the Nachri can use cold water. And therefore, you get around the Bishul problem. Oh, they're choosing to use hot water because it's easier for them to clean the dishes with hot water. It will take less time. Okay, that's their own convenience. That's what we refer to as Adaita the Nafshe. But over here, when it comes to the sponge, how do you get around that? So, any of you ever seen in your homes a Shabbos sponge? You have a Shabbos sponge? Anybody know what a Shabbos sponge is? If you don't have it in your home, you should get one. What? It's a non-absorbent sponge. It's like it has bristles that are non-absorbent. So if you have a situation like that and you leave that next to the sink, you're now giving the Nachri, I'm presenting you two options on how to wash the dishes. You can wash the dishes the normal way, which is with the sponge, which will be much more convenient. Or you can wash it with a Shabbos sponge, which doesn't work as well. But it is doable, and it's not so terrible. And therefore, if you have a situation like that, once again, we would say that is called Adaita the Nafshe. If the Nachri so chooses to then do it with hot water and the non-Shabbos sponge, that is a decision that they're making on their own for their own comfort to make it easier for themselves. And therefore, that would be permissible. Okay? Is that clear? I think that's extremely relevant, something that we all need to know about. Okay, so yeah, just one point on what we said before. The Shemir Shabbos Kachasa points out that, let's say I have that hotel case, right, and I have the pack and play all the way on the 12th floor. So we said that that's something that you would say is probably unreasonable. Let's say I say, I want you to bring burning hot soup, a whole pot of burning hot soup up to my room. So like, again, it's hard to imagine that they're going to bring up burning hot soup by walking up flights of stairs either. So you have to just be reasonable. You have to think about what it is that you're asking for and whether or not there's a realistic possibility that this is something that can ever be done in a permissible way on Shabbos, or perhaps not. A very common question that comes up is, when I want to drop my clothing off at the dry cleaner. So am I allowed to drop off the clothing at the dry cleaner before Shabbos when I know that they're probably going to do the work on Shabbos itself? Or for that matter, I need my car to be fixed, so I want to bring it to the car mechanic. Am I allowed to bring it on Friday afternoon, knowing that they're probably going to do some kind of malacha on Shabbos itself? Is that something that is permissible? Or a more common example is, what's a great example for those of us in this generation?
When you order something online.
Order something online, Amazon Prime, right? So if I'm ordering Amazon Prime, what do I do then? The fact that I know that they're going to deliver it on Shabbos, would that be permissible? Are all of these cases the same, or perhaps they are different? Let us just get into this a little bit. What we need to know, by way of introduction to this halacha, we need to know that the Shulchan Aruch writes that there are two categories of workers that you can have working for you in any given arrangement that you have. One is referred to as a kabla. A kabla means, I hired an employee to do a job. I hire a plumber to fix the toilet. I don't care how long it takes him to do the job. Sometimes a plumber will come, it's a 5-minute job, they give you a $500 bill. How can that be? That's the way it goes, right? They're hired for the job. They're hired to fix something. You hire a painter. If he does the job in 2 hours or in 6 hours, that's his prerogative. Of course, I want it to be done faster. I want them out of my house. But I pay him for the job. I don't pay him for the hour. That's what's referred to as a kabla. If you have, let's say, a cleaners, I'm not paying them dependent on how hard it is to clean this item. You know, if you give me a shirt, which is much more straightforward, so then it's only going to cost you this. If you give me that, no, that's not the way it goes. So generally we assume, or that is the way it goes. What am I saying? Now when you go there, they have different prices for different things. But I'm not sure that it's because you're paying a person by the hour. You're paying them for the job. If it turns out that they're able to do this in 5 minutes instead of 5 hours, so great. They're still going to get paid the same amount. So that is what's referred to as a kabla. The second kind of business arrangement I can have with an employee is what's referred to as a schir yom. What's a schir yom? Exactly what it sounds like. It means I hired you for the day. I'm paying you by the hour. I'm not paying you for the job. I'm paying you based on the work that you are doing. So say, for example, I have a cleaning personnel in my house. I have somebody who comes to clean up my store. I have a custodian. So in a situation like that, I'm paying them for the amount of work that they do. If it takes them 5 hours, I'm going to pay them X. If it takes them 6 hours, I'm going to pay them Y. So that's what's referred to as a schir yom. As a general rule, without getting into all the specifics, and there are books written about this, because this really is extremely cutting edge in Hilchos Shabbos nowadays, because we have many Jews who own real estate enterprises or real estate empires. And what are you going to say? Every Shabbos, we're just going to close the business? So if I own a supermarket, so I close the business for Shabbos. If I own real estate, what am I going to do? I have an apartment. I have 150 people living in the building. What am I going to say? None of my workers should work? So somebody's toilet gets clogged, or somebody has a leak, somebody has a flood, somebody's electricity goes out. So I need to have personnel on the ground who are available to help the people who are having a problem. But how can I do that? I'm running a business on Shabbos. I'm making money. The people are paying me rent, right? So how does that work? You got to learn how to do the save. She wasn't watching. It's pretty good. So you missed it. When you drop bottles on the floor, you got to know how to catch them. So the question is, how do you run a business like that when you know that the business has to run on Shabbos? There's no such thing as closing it down on Shabbos. Correct? No, anyone ever think about this? Maybe no one's planning on going to real estate. But this is a very serious question. Or if you own a nursing home, it's the same as real estate, right? You can't shut down the nursing home just because it's Shabbos. But how can you run an effective business on Shabbos without violating Shabbos itself? How do I have employees doing all this kind of work for me? So these are very, very serious cutting-edge shailas, and what you have to look into in all these questions is, who is a kablan, who's a schir yom, what exactly is the arrangement, who owns the business, how much am I paying them, what am I paying them for? So this is a very, very complicated area of halacha. In fact, there's a Beis Din in Lakewood that gave me a gift around 6 months to a year ago, I forgot. It's like a boutique book. It's really not a boutique, it's like a coffee table book all about this. They made a conference for, I think it was geared toward professionals who are in real estate and nursing homes. There are so many Jews in this business, and there are many, many questions that come up. And they realize that there are so many of them that are calling with the same exact questions. So they put a book together with all these shaylos, trying to figure out the scenarios, and then giving the answers based on the Shulchan Aruch, when it would be permissible and when perhaps not. It's a very interesting book. If you want to borrow it, you can. I don't have time to read it. But as a general rule, we have these two categories of workers. We have a kablam and we have a schir yom. How would that make a difference when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos? So the Shulchan Aruch writes as follows. A kablam who does work on Shabbos, let's say I hire a contractor. Any of you have had construction on your home recently, right? You had such a thing? So when you have a contractor who's doing construction on a house, so I'm paying them not based on the amount of hours that they spend on the work. I'm paying them based on the work that they ultimately accomplish. I want them to build me a basement. I want them to build me a furniture. So in a situation like that, the Shulchan Aruch says, he needs to figure out how to allocate his time and when he should work in order to get his work done. I'm not instructing him when to come. If he decides he wants to do the work at 8 o'clock in the morning instead of 8 o'clock at night, he can. If he decides he's better working at midnight and that's a more effective way for him to do the work, That's also fine. That's his decision. That's his decision to make. And therefore, when you have a Kamlan, it's much simpler when it comes to Shabbos. If he chooses to do his work on Shabbos, that's not that I told him to do it on Shabbos, that's him deciding to do it on Shabbos. So that would be permissible. So say, for example, if I drop off the clothing at the cleaners, so if I walk in 1 minute before Shabbos and I say, this has to be ready the second Shabbos is over, then obviously that's not permissible. Why? Because I'm asking him explicitly to do Malacha on Shabbos. But let's say I say to him, I come in Friday afternoon and I say, I need to pick this up on Monday. I'll be back, you know, after the weekend. So he can choose to do it Friday afternoon in, you know, the 2-3 hours before Shabbos begins. He can choose to do it on Matzah Shabbos or Sunday. Now, he happens to watch the football game on Sunday, so he doesn't want to be in the store doing the work on Sunday. So instead, he chooses to do it on Shabbos. Yeah, but that's his own decision. That's Hadai Tidei Nafshei. That's because he wants to do it. So in that case, he's a Kablan. I'm not hiring him and paying him for the specific hours that he's working. I'm paying him for the job itself. And as a result of that, if he chooses to do his own job at a time that's convenient for him, that would not be a problem, even if he chooses to do that on Shabbos itself. Because in essence, he's really working for himself and not working for me. Is that clear? However, the Shulchan Aruch says there are two conditions to allow this to be done on Shabbos. Condition number one is that you are not mitzavehim beferush sheyavod b'Shabbos. I cannot explicitly tell him, look, it's 5 minutes to Shabbos and I need this the minute Shabbos is over. I'm going to be back. I have a wedding I have to go to. Jumping on a plane, I'm not allowed to do that. Or I go in with my car right before Shabbos and I say, listen, I need my car all days of the week. I'm a very busy person. I have meetings. I have to go places. I really don't have time. The minute Shabbos is over, this better be fixed. If I say that, then basically I'm telling him, I need you to do Malacha on Shabbos. So condition number one is, I have to leave a reasonable amount of time for him to actually have done the Malacha before or after Shabbos. I have to give him that option. And then if he himself chooses to do it on Shabbos, that's a different story. That's his own decision. But that's condition number one. The Shulchan Aruch says the only way to allow a Kablan to do Malacha for me is if I actually gave them the opportunity to do it at a different time other than Shabbos, and then they choose to do it on their own. Number two, the second condition is that he's not doing the Malacha bebeso shel ha'Yisrael. He's not doing the Malacha in the house of a Jew. The Mishnah Berurah says, in a situation like that, if he's going to come to my house and do work for me, let's say I have a painter in the house. Nobody knows that I didn't hire him to come today. Everybody who walks by sees the painter in the house. They don't know that he decided to come today. They think, I hired him to come today. So if it's the Beis Shel Yisrael, that means it's going to be so obvious that he's doing the Malacha for me on Shabbos. That would not be permissible. So those are the two conditions. My father once gave an example. I seem to remember when I was in the shir many years ago. So my father gave an example of this, and he said the following. Let's say I give my car to the car mechanic. So what do we say? That would be permissible. Why? Because I tell him, I'll come pick it up Sunday night, Monday morning, whatever it may be. You have plenty of time. He chooses to fix it on Shabbos, that's him. What if the car mechanic gets my car, and I happen to be a Chabad Shaliach somewhere, and it's Hanukkah time, and I'm sure all of us have seen the Shluchim around Hanukkah time have a big menorah coming out of the sunroof of their cars. No? You've seen this? So I give my car in to be repaired, and everybody who walks by seeing the repairman do the work on Shabbos sees that this big menorah is sticking out of the car. Right? So it's very obvious that you're doing Malacha for a Jew on Shabbos. Would that be the same as Beis Shel Yisrael?
Or that bumper sticker also.
So my father's not so familiar with bumper stickers. That's why he gave us the example of the menorahs. But I think that would be a very interesting question. If everybody... So again, if the auto mechanic is somewhere out of the neighborhood and nowhere to be seen, and he's just doing things on his own time, that's different. But if he's in the neighborhood and everybody sees that he's doing something that's clearly for me, then that would be similar, I think, to a case of Beis Shel Yisrael. And that would be problematic. I seem to believe that's what my father said, that even though it's not technically in my house, but it's so clear to anybody who walks by that it's being done on behalf of a Jew, and that would be problematic. So let me just think. Somebody called me a couple of weeks ago with a Shiloh. This man who lives in our neighborhood owns a real estate company. He has this very large empty space, and somebody wanted to come to look at the venue to decide whether or not they wanted to rent it. It's like a part of a mall, and they wanted to decide whether or not they wanted to become a vendor and take one of the spaces in the mall to open up a store. So what was his question? His question was, right now the whole place is vacant. there's nobody there. It's going to ultimately become a mall, but right now it's not. So the question was, am I able to have somebody on Shabbos who is coming to check out the venue to consider maybe paying rent in the future if they choose to use it as time goes on? So he wanted to know, is there anything wrong? Is that called doing business on Shabbos? I tell him, look, the place is open. The whole place is unlocked. Go inside. Look around. Do whatever you want to do. So what would you say? What would you say? Is that called doing business on Shabbos?
You can come another time. So you could say that it's like someone that you're hiring to do work eventually. Also, it's not for sure that you're doing business.
So I think you don't have to come on to the fancy answer that you just gave. I think you should just go much more simple, which is, this is not even business. He's coming to check it out. I'm not signing a contract. I'm not doing a handshake. I'm not there. I left the facility open. It's in a part of the neighborhood which is completely not Jewish. It was in Garden City, which is like nowhere near the Frum community at all. So nobody who sees this person coming into the establishment will say, oh, you see the Jews doing business on Shabbos, people coming in, people going out. Nobody even knows who owns it. The owner doesn't live there. The owner is not part of the community there. The owner is a businessman who lives somewhere else who invested in this property. So I told him that I think it was not a problem. I hope I was correct. I think it's not a problem at all to do that because nothing's actually being done. All he's doing is walking around, checking it out, deciding whether or not he wants to ultimately make a deal. He's not calling me on Shabbos to follow up. He's going to call me next week and he's going to let me know what he thinks. So I think that would be permissible. Again, you have to think about this consideration of Beis Oshel Yisrael, and it makes a big difference whether or not this is something that's in the Jewish community or perhaps not. There was a local school in the five towns that was that bought a new building, Shalamet. I don't know if anyone's familiar. And they were trying to get the building finished. They were doing major construction on the building. They were trying to get it finished in order that the kids should be able to have a school to go to. And not just the gym, just the school itself.
It was a gym.
Right, so they were trying to convert it to be classrooms and figure it out. So the problem was that it was becoming very, very tight, and they were trying to find time to actually be able to finish up the project in time for September 1. So that was a big, big issue that they had. So they called me about it, and they said, can we have the Nachrim do the Malacha on Shabbos? Can we have them come in? After all, they are Kablanim. After all, so one second, after all, we hired them for the job. We're not paying them by the hour. So can we then tell them, now that we're down to the wire, can we tell them that we want them to come on Shabbos as well? And I said, absolutely not. That is Beis Oshel Yisrael. That's terrible. That's in the middle of the Jewish community. Everybody knows that this is a Jewish school. Everybody sees them going in and out. That would be a horrible message to send to the community, and that is something that we would not allow. And I said, maybe in the schus of your being Shomer Shabbos the way you're supposed to, maybe the kids will get into school on September 1, which they did. I can't say I'm a miracle worker. It had nothing to do with me. The workers did the work, and that's why it was finished.
What if they had not announced that their school would be there? Like, if someone was doing construction, nobody knows who it is.
So is that really the case? We live in a community of Yentis. I don't know. And maybe not in your block. You know, in my part of the neighborhood, come on. You know, like, really? Somebody doesn't know what this is? Hard for me to imagine. And that's why I think it's a big mistake. Sometimes people buy a house and they say, well, I'm not moving in yet, so they're allowed to do the work whenever they want. That's not correct. That's not true.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, there's everybody knows that a Frum person bought the house. If you're buying a house on one of our blocks, it means you're Frum. Nobody who's not Frum.
I have one non-Jewish neighbor.
What?
I have one non-Jewish neighbor.
I also have one non-Jewish neighbor. I think we have the only two in all of Woodmere, actually. Yeah, so,
actually,
yes.
I live in Cedarhurst.
Cedarhurst, okay. So you're the Cedarhurst token non-Jew, and I'm the Woodmere token non-Jew. Yes. Wonderful. Okay, you had a question? Answered? Okay, great. Okay, now we move on to Amazon Prime. All right, so that's the obvious next step. So Amazon Prime, the problem is that I'm specifically paying for a service where I'm asking them to do same-day delivery or next-day delivery, right? So the contemporary post can say that if I'm asking someone to deliver the package tomorrow and they're going to guarantee me it's going to be here on Shabbos, that's a problem. If I give them a window and I say, listen, you know, you can come by Tuesday, it has to be here. By Monday, it has to be here. By Sunday night, it has to be here. So if they're choosing to do the work quicker and they want to get here on Shabbos, that would not be a problem. So that's just something to keep in mind. If you're going to If you're going to order a package and you have Amazon Prime, you should try not to set it up to come on Shabbos itself, because then you're asking a Nachri to do a malacha for you on Shabbos itself. The Archa Shabbos does quote a big heter, where he says, "B'makom hefsid meruba," if it's something that's going to be a big loss, then he says that you would be allowed to have that package delivered on Shabbos. Why? Anybody remember why? This is from two shiurim ago. Let's see who's listening. We quoted, the Mishnah Brura quotes from the Chavos Yair, Rabbi Yair Bachrach in the 1600s, that if you do something that's referred to as Amira de Amira, if it's twice removed, you ask one Nachri to ask another Nachri, then some say that would not be considered a prohibition of Amira le Nachri. We do not accept that. The Mishnah Brura says, however, B'makom hefsed meruba, if it's something that's extenuating circumstances, you can rely on that opinion, and you're allowed to have them one ask another, which makes it very far removed from your original instruction. So in this case, when you order from Amazon, you're not having the delivery done directly from the person you spoke to, or directly from the person who took your order. They're going to take the order, pass it on to someone else, is going to pass it to someone else, give it to somebody else, who's then going to put it on the truck, then have a delivery person who's going to deliver it to somebody else, and finally it's going to get to your house. That is Amira da Amira da Amira da Amira a million times over. If it's a Hefsin Meruba, which I don't know what that situation would be, but if it's a Hefsin Meruba, then we would say potentially that would be permissible. But if not, if it's a normal case where I'm just ordering something on Amazon and for my own convenience I want it to be brought to me immediately, that would be something that really should not be done. And even in a case where you are allowed to have the package that was delivered to you on Shabbos, right? Even in that situation where I said, you know, I want to have 2-day shipping, and it turns out that they drop it off on Shabbos itself. Even in that situation, we still have to be mindful of the fact that a Nachri who does malacha for me on Shabbos, I'm not allowed to derive benefit until Bechdei Sheyasu, until Shabbos is over, and there's enough time for that malacha to have been done. So if, let's say, it takes an hour or two to drive from the Amazon factory to my house, or wherever the warehouse is, I would have to keep that in mind, that after Shabbos, I really should not derive benefit from those packages until I wait that amount of time once Shabbos is completed. Okay, you had a question?
Yeah.
We're
not supposed to ask an Amru to do malacha for us because we don't want to be surrounded by people who are doing malacha, so we don't do malacha.
Right.
If we're not even seeing the person deliver the package, not around us, not influencing us, isn't it a whole part that to say that we wouldn't be allowed to do something beforehand? So
excellent question. That's an excellent question. So, for anyone who may not have heard, the question is, if the whole prohibition of Amira the Nachri, of asking a non-Jew, a Gentile, to do malacha for us is because we don't want to have malacha going on all over, we're going to ultimately do it ourselves, isn't this a little far-fetched when we don't even see the person who's delivering the package? It has nothing at all to do with us. The answer is, there are three reasons why Amira the Nachri is prohibited on Shabbos. Reason number one is because it's as if he's doing the work for me, he is my proxy, he's my shaliach. Reason number two is because of the Dabra Dabra, that I'm not allowed to give instruction to someone to do something because I'm not allowed to talk in that way on Shabbos about business. Reason number three is because we don't want to have so much malacha going on around us, because ultimately we might come to do the malacha ourselves. Between those three reasons, one of them applies to this scenario as well, right?
The last one?
I would say the first one, Shaliach. He's doing malacha on my behalf. It's as if it's an extension of me doing malacha, and therefore it would be a problem, even though maybe he's going to drop it off at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm not even going to see him, but that would still be, technically that would still be a problem. So let's say you have, this is a common question, let's say you have a newspaper delivery, alright, so you order the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, whatever it is, and you have it come to your house every day. So what would be the halacha then? So problem number one is that a daily newspaper is printed on Shabbos itself. They want to have the news that's fit to print, but they can't have yesterday's news, they have to have today's news. So they print it, I don't know, at midnight, or I don't know, anybody know? When do they print the newspapers? I guess in the middle of the night at some point, and then they send it out for delivery. So that is something that was actually created on Shabbos. That's called Nola. And that is a major, major problem. Most assume that that would be considered muktzah on Shabbos because it was printed on Shabbos itself. And this is a common misconception. People get the paper and they think that it's totally fine. It's not so simple that it's fine. Leaving that aside, how did the paper get to me? You had a delivery boy who went around driving through the neighborhood dropping off all the papers. So if I live in a predominantly non-Jewish neighborhood, so you'll say he's driving for all the non-Jews anyway, so he's not really doing any extra malacha for me. He's driving down my block because he has to deliver it to 10 other people, so he's dropping it off by me. That's not really an extra malacha. But if you live in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood where he is doing the malacha for the Jews primarily, then that would be potentially a very serious question. Yeah?
Can you apply that to the Amazon packages? Like if you live in a non-Jewish neighborhood, where Amazon delivery is not coming anyway.
Yeah.
So then you would be able to open your...
Like, right after Shabbos, like, yeah.
Then you don't have to wait the time that it takes.
Correct. Yes, that is correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Why would you be able to argue that in general with the newspapers, they're not specifically printed for, like, deliveries for maybe a specific area, but when they're printed for like a massive population and that's sent out, mm-hmm. and that's, even if you live in a predominantly Jewish area, the newspaper itself being printed is not just for Jews.
That's correct. But even leaving that aside, should that make a difference in terms of muktzah? We haven't discussed muktzah. Maybe we should have some shiur on muktzah. I'm just curious. Can I ask for a minute? Did most people in the room, I just don't know. Did most people in the room go to Israel for the year? Yeah? Some yes, some no? Okay, so in Israel for the year, do they learn Hilchos Shabbos? So is everything we learned already discussed there? So what do you learn?
Personally, I learned Mitzvot Aseh mostly.
So like Kiddush, Havdalah, Neir Shabbos.
Bishul.
A lot of Bishul. So everybody knows Bishul?
So we
so we shouldn't do Bishul? Are we sure review Bishul anyway?
Yeah, it's always good to review Bishul.
Okay, let's see. All the Bishul experts. A woman in the shul wrote to me yesterday. So she wants to know. She wants to leave on her oven on 200 degrees. And she wants to leave a potato kugel in there overnight and take it out Shabbos morning. Permissible or not? Who's going to be brave? Yeah.
If it was already mostly cooked, then it's fine.
It was cooked before Shabbos. Yeah. What do you say?
Also, the question is, like, when you're opening the oven, is it too much change of temperature?
Shabbos mode. Yeah, Shabbos mode's a big, big, you know, issue.
But some ovens have, like...
Shabbos mode is really Yom Tov mode. It's not a Shabbos mode.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's complicated.
The question is, when you're opening the oven, is it going to take a turn on the oven
cycle? Also. Anyway, lots of questions. Shabbos is complicated. A lot to think about. But I was just thinking that the other day. Like, if everybody learned Hilchos Shabbos in seminary, you have to tell me what's left to learn. Or we'll just continue doing our thing, and when it gets boring, you'll let me know. How's that? Okay, deal. Now, what about if I have in-house help? What's the halacha then? Oh, sorry, yeah.
How do you define predominantly Jewish people? How many Jews?
A majority, right?
I mean, yeah, it's like pretty 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So then the malacha is being done anyway, right? Basically, the work is being done anyway for everybody else there. Yeah. Okay, so now we get to the next question, which is very, very relevant. When you have in-house help, if you have in-house help, is that considered to be a kablon or a schir yom? As we said before, there are two relationships you can have with an employee. You can have a kablon, which is somebody who's hired to do the job. You can have a schir yom, who's basically paid by the hour. So what would you say the status of somebody who works in your house is? A cleaning woman.
I would say a schir yom.
Right? Seems clear to me that it's a schir yom. You pay them by the hour. If they don't show up, they don't get paid. If they stay longer because you had extra company and the house is a bigger mess and they decide they want to do you a favor and stay an extra 2 hours, you pay them more, correct? So I would have said that is considered to be a schir yom. However, Rav Moshe has a tremendous chiddush. Rav Moshe says if you have a live-in, not someone who just pops in and pops out, but you have someone who's a live-in, Rav Moshe says even though it's a schir yom and you do have an arrangement for them to pay them by the hour or by the week, whatever it may be, Rav Moshe says that would still be considered like a kablon. Why is that like a kablon? The answer is, says Rav Moshe, although it's true that the person is being paid by the hour, by the week, but Rav Moshe argues there's room to say here that it should still be permissible on Shabbos. Why? Because in the end of the day, what is the job of this person? The job is, I want my house to be clean at the end of the day. When I come home at 6:30, 7 o'clock at night, I want everything to be where it's supposed to be. I want things to be in order. How you're going to figure out when to do it, how to do it, that's your problem. You got to figure that out. It's not my problem. It's your problem to figure it out. That person doesn't work every day of the week, right? Even if you have live-in help, they go out one day a week. They leave, right? They go home for one day a week or 2 days a week. So they're living in most of the time. Now, they can choose to go home either on Shabbos or they can choose to go home on Sunday. For their own convenience, they decided that they want to come work on Shabbos instead of on Sunday because they want to watch the football game. Okay, that's called Adaita D'Nafshei. That's called a Kavlon who's deciding to do it on his own time. So if they happen to be in my house on Shabbos, or Moshe says, that would be okay so long as this is the kind of worker that is there on a full-time basis. Obviously, full-time doesn't mean full-time, but that would be more similar, Moshe says, to a Kavlon than it would be to a Schir Yom, even though the monetary arrangement that I have with this employee is more like a Schir Yom. But the general understanding of what they're supposed to do is more similar to a Kavlon. Does that make sense? It's an interesting chiddush, but that's where Moshe says. However, he says, that would not give them a license to do, let's say, vacuuming in my house or to do the washing machine on Shabbos. Why? Because that makes noise. So that's a different problem. I'm not allowed to have a machine running in my house on Shabbos that is going to make noise. But outside of that, let's say, every week they fold the laundry. It turns out there's a whole pile of laundry. And for their own convenience, it's easier for them to fold the laundry on Shabbos than it would be to stay, you know, a different time and do it then. So that's for themselves. Their job, Ramosha says, is to make sure the house is in order. Part of making sure the house is in order is to make sure that all the laundry is folded. And therefore, Ramosha argues that would be something that would be permissible, that would not be a problem. That's an interesting chiddush. However, the problem would be if you only have somebody who's hired to come for a couple of hours, right, which many people don't have a live-in. Many people don't have help at all. But for those who do have help, if you don't have a live-in and you just hire someone because you're having so much company and you want them to come for a couple of hours on Shabbos, that would be a Schir Yom. That would be an employee that's being paid by the hour, and that would be very problematic on Shabbos. That would be very problematic on Shabbos. Beyond that, the Mishnah Berurah writes that if you have a situation where you have that person coming to do the malacha for you on Shabbos itself, you have to make sure, how are you going to pay them? How are you going to pay them? So if you have a live-in and you give them a salary once a week, so you give them a salary once a week. But what about somebody who only comes for 3 hours on Shabbos? So what do you do then? Anyone ever think of this? So the Shmir Shabbos Gathasa writes that to have money set aside and to then tell the non-Jew, you know, here's the money, that would be a problem. Why? Because that's Mecha Humemker. You're not allowed to do business on Shabbos. That's doing business on Shabbos. You came to my house, you provided a service, I'm paying you for it. That's Mecha Humemker but Shabbos. What's wrong with doing business on Shabbos? Is that an Issa D'Oraisa, Issa D'Rabbanan? Is that biblical? It's rabbinic? Right, so business transactions, usually you want to have a receipt. You want to make sure that it's clear that there was a transaction. So the concern is, if you're going to do a business transaction on Shabbos, that's going to lead you to write something down. And therefore the Chachamim, therefore the rabbis, prohibited one from doing business on Shabbos. What's fascinating about that is, in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, I often think about this. Imagine in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, what was Shabbos like? Like, what was the Torah Shabbos like before the rabbis came along and changed everything? I think if Moshe Rabbeinu came back to our world today, we would say he's an apikoros, right? He's a mechal Shabbos. I think we would all agree. No? What do they do on Shabbos? It says, Lo sasa kol malacha. You're not allowed to do any malacha. What malachas did they used to do back then? They used to work the field. So they didn't work the field on Shabbos. They used to work their animals. Okay, no animals on Shabbos. Now what? What are you left with? So what do they do? Shabbos was the great time to go to the mall. No? So everybody walked to the mall. They all went shopping the whole Shabbos. There's no problem to do business. Imagine the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's the way everyone kept Shabbos. Why not? There's no better time to go do all your shopping for the week. During the week, I'm so busy working. I don't have time to go to the mall. Shabbos is relaxing. Can you imagine if you spent your whole Shabbos every week going to the mall? Moshe Rabbeinu came down today, he wouldn't recognize our Shabbos. He wouldn't know what's going on. So Shabbos is very different than it used to be. But we have a prohibition of Mekach HaMemker, of doing a business transaction on Shabbos. And the Mishnah Berurah says, if that's the case, and I have a Sfir Yom, and I have somebody who's paid by the hour, coming to my house to do work on Shabbos, how can it be that I'm allowed to give them money on Shabbos? I have to leave the money somewhere for them that after Shabbos they can come, and they can figure out how to get paid, or they have to trust me. And that doesn't always work, right? Because sometimes you have somebody who just comes as a one-off, and they say, what do you mean? Oh, okay. So this is a very, very serious issue that we need to think about. If you're going to have help in the house on Shabbos, you might want to pay them beforehand. You might want to tell them beforehand that you're going to pay them after Shabbos. They should come right after Shabbos is over, or you'll sell them the money, or whatever it may be. But just to figure out some kind of arrangement is something that would be very important. Now, selling the money, you know, not every worker that comes to everybody's house is always legal. So you have to figure it out. You know, I saw somebody the other day, and I asked this person, I saw them walking near my house, and they walk by all the time. So, you know, I always say hello. It's someone else's babysitter, so I asked, did you vote today? It was November 8th. I said, did you vote? She says, what? I said, did you vote? You know, governor, New York. What? I said, are you a citizen? She says, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, okay, I guess you're not. I guess you're not voting. So I guess you got to be careful with what kind of questions you ask. Anyway, we spoke a lot about Amira La'akum and how it relates to Hilchos Shabbos. It's a very, very important set of halachos. It comes up all the time. And it's something people are really not so careful about. And that is why the Mishnah Berurah warns us that we should be familiar with the rules of Amir La'akum. We really just gave a very brief overview of the halacha, and I think it's important for all of us to be aware of. What I think you're probably less aware of is the fact that the Gemara in Maseches Bava Metzia has a discussion whether or not this prohibition of Amir La'akum spills over, whether it extends to other areas of halacha as well. Does Amir La'akum spill over to other areas of halacha as well? So there are a number of examples. One extremely relevant and practical example that comes up all the time, and I don't know how many people in the room have pets in the house, but having a pet, being a Jewish pet owner, is possible, it's doable, but you should just know that there are so many halachic obstacles you have to overcome. Just to name a few of them. Shabbos is a big obstacle. Many say that pets on Shabbos are muktzah. That's question number one. Question number two comes up all the time, Pesach time. A lot of the food, for anyone who has a pet, don't be embarrassed. It's okay. It's doable, I said. But you just have to think about all of the halachic challenges that come along with it. Shabbos is a very big challenge. Pet food sometimes is basar machalav. Sometimes it's not kosher. Which, okay, there's no prohibition to feed my animal basar b'chalav, that's fine. But what about buying the basar b'chalav? So I'm going to go to a pet shop to buy non-kosher food. So is that permissible or not to buy that food? When we talk about chametz b'pesach, so very often you'll have animal food that is actual chametz on Pesach. So what do you do about that? But the most fundamental of issues is neutering a dog. Anybody here have a dog? No? You have a dog? Is the dog neutered, I assume? What? It's okay. So, neutering the dog is a very serious question. There's an issur in the Torah called siris. You're not allowed to be involved in castration. And siris applies not only to a human being, but also to an animal. We're not allowed to be misaris of behema. So the question is, I want to neuter the dog not because I want the dog to suffer. I want to neuter the dog because I want the dog to be tame. I want the dog to be calm. I want to be allowed into certain buildings with my dog. If I don't neuter the dog, they're not going to let me in. Is that correct?
No, my dog's a girl.
What?
My dog's a girl.
Your dog's a girl. That's one way around the problem. Okay. So, yours also?
No, yours also? Boy, I just don't know what the rules are.
He is neutered,
yes.
Right? So it could be you purchased the dog and it was already neutered. That's unusual. That usually doesn't happen.
Usually, a long time, so probably not.
Okay, whatever it is. So there are many reasons to neuter an animal, and it's not because we hate the animal, and it's not because we want to be cruel to the animal. It's because we want to help the animal. And some say, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think some say that it also helps the animal avoid certain cancers that it can develop in those reproductive organs, and that's why some really want to advocate for doing that. Be it as it may, it's a major problem. It's an issur d'oraisa to neuter an animal. It's a biblical prohibition for a Jew to be involved in neutering an animal. So what do we do? Well, I'm not the vet. I'm not going to do it. I actually got a shiloh once from a girl in our community who wanted to become a vet. And she said that most of the work that she's going to be doing is neutering animals. So I'm like, how do you get such a parnassah? How can you take such a job? Like, that's just not permissible at all. Anyway, so if you're thinking of going to school to become a vet, you should consider that consideration. But the question that often families have is, what do? They want to neuter the animal, but they can't neuter the animal because it's an issur d'oraisa. So what do? You go to the vet, and you have the vet do it. That's amir l'nachri. The example that the Gemara gives above Metzia about extending amir l'nachri to other areas of halacha is this example, siras behema. This is the example that it gives. Giving my animal to a Gentile to do the neutering for me. Is that something that's permissible, or perhaps not? Let me read you a shaila, which is a very sad shaila, but a very fascinating one. The shaila came up. It was not yet published, but it's a fascinating shaila that Rav Asher Weiss discussed with me. So the shaila was from Santiago, Chile. Anybody here from Chile? That's in the next class, okay. The question was from Santiago, Chile. And the Rav of the community sends the following shaila. Maisa b'kohen. Shenasei l'nachriya zeh shanim rabot. There's a kohen in the community who was married to a non-Jewish woman for many years. Vizela achrona chazer b'tshuva. And recently he became a baal tshuva. Vihi gamhi nasaliba likanis libris ulakabal al asma ol Yehudis. So this person grew up totally unaffiliated, didn't even know that there was a concept of only marrying a Jew, didn't know that there was any issue with intermarriage. He was married to this non-Jewish woman, they had a wonderful marriage, everything was fine. He became a baal tshuva. Now he realizes he's not allowed to remain married to this non-Jewish woman. So what does he do? So what he does is he tries to work on his wife and asks her whether she's interested in converting. Does she also want to become a baal tshuva? She says yes. I mean, a baal tshuva is not the right word. But does she want to convert to become a giyores and then a baal tshuva to then live an orthodox, affirm lifestyle? So she also agrees that this is what she wants to do. Wonderful couple, beautiful. What's the problem? What? Vida'aka. Kasha lahem lalos ala das gerishit. Ubifrat. La'achar shabiyachad hiskarbu liyadus. They just went through a journey together. Not only a journey of 25 years of marriage that was wonderful and raising children and having a beautiful family and all of that was great and life experience together, but beyond that, they just went through the journey of coming to Judaism together. And now you're going to say that because he's a Kohen, he has to divorce his wife? After all that? So what does he do? So he came up with a great idea. What's a way to invalidate his kahuna? What's a way to shed himself of his kedushas kahuna? How do you do that?
Instead of his parents.
If what?
I'm going to say his parents are divorced.
If his parents are divorced? No, that wouldn't make a difference. When he was born, he was born, right? So how would you strip a kohen of his kahuna, which would then allow him to marry a woman who he's not allowed to marry? So here's his idea. La'achar sha'ish badak esa'inyin. He looked into it a little bit. Gamar ve'omer lavor nituach siras. He decides he wants to get a vasectomy. A vasectomy means he wants to castrate himself. That's, in Chumash, something that will invalidate the kedushas kahuna. The Torah says if you have a kohen who had a vasectomy, he's not allowed to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. He loses his Kedushas Kahuna. That's usually looked at as a bad thing. In this case, it's a great thing. He's going to get rid of his Kedushas Kahuna and stay with his wife, who he loves so much. This is brilliant, this guy. So what do you say? You know how this came about, actually? I remember the Shaila. The way it came about was the guy started going to the Daf Yomi Shir. And he was like percolating in his mind, what's he going to do back and forth? What's he going to do? His wife is becoming Jewish. And she's going to become Orthodox, and now he's going to have to tell her that he's divorcing her, and how can he divorce her? He has so many grandchildren. Well, what's it going to be? And he hears one day, they're learning Meseches Yevamos. Meseches Yevamos, the Gemara talks about a krus shavcha, a saras and a krus shavcha. What happens if you have somebody who had one of these procedures that makes him infertile? And he says, hey, this is a great idea. Why don't I voluntarily get a vasectomy This way, I will then get rid of my own problem of kahuna and then be able to remain with my wife. Yeah?
Why does he have to divorce her if he were to stay, they got religious?
Why does he have to divorce her if she became a gioris, right? That's your question? So a kohen is not allowed to marry a gioris, right? So that there are a number of people that a kohen is not allowed to marry. One of them would be a woman who, this kind of woman. Not because there's anything wrong with her, just our rules and regulations of who a kohen is allowed to marry. So that is the general problem that he had, and he came up with this great idea, am I allowed to get a vasectomy? So part of the shaila is, he's not going to do it to himself, he's going to go to a hospital. When he goes to the hospital, the chances are it's going to be a non-Jewish doctor, or he'll make sure to have a non-Jewish doctor. Can he instruct a non-Jewish doctor to do this iser for him, which he's not going to do himself, but that would be amir la'akum. Would that be permissible? I would say in this case it's makom tzarach gadol. And maybe we would say amira da amira, right? You're not going to ask the surgeon yourself. You're going to ask one person who's going to put the team together and ask somebody else to ask somebody else who all together are going to do it. This was a fascinating, fascinating shaila. Something to think about. We don't have enough time to talk about it, but it's very hard to say. It's just as a general rule. It's very hard to say when you're called with such a question. How can I say with a good conscience, yeah, you should violate this in order to circumvent the system? If he would have come to me afterward and said, this is what I did and I want to know, can I stay married? That's a different shaila. But the question is, can you approve my going ahead and doing this in order to invalidate myself from kahuna, which would then allow me to do what I need to do? Is that permissible or not? Right? So we have, I mean, it's not exactly the same, but every so often, you have a situation where you have, you know, we shouldn't talk about such things, but they happen. Generally, the halacha is a single girl is not allowed to go to the mikveh. Even though a single girl is a nida, just like a married woman, right? So why doesn't she go to the mikveh? In the days of the Beis HaMikdash, she would go to the mikveh. Why? Because Tumah V'Tahara was very relevant back then for single and married women. You weren't allowed to go to the Beis HaMikdash, you weren't allowed to eat kachim or truma, all of that was relevant. Today, it's only relevant for a woman to be together with a man. So what if you have a single girl who wants to go to the mikveh? Why does she want to go to the mikveh? Because she wants to be with a man. But she's not married to this man. So she's not allowed to be with him. So you run the mikveh, and you're called by this woman, and you're asked, are you going to allow me to use the mikveh? Because I don't want to violate the isser of nida, that's an isser kares. I'm going to be with my boyfriend. I know what's going to happen. Am I allowed to use the mikveh? And what's the answer? What would you say? Now, her argument makes sense, right? It would be a terrible thing to violate an issur kares. But me, as the one being asked the question, how can I say, yeah, you should circumvent the system by tricking everybody and going to the mikveh in order that you should be able to do something you're not allowed to do? You're not allowed to be with your boyfriend in that way before you're married. So, these kinds of questions sometimes come up. This is just one example. But again, the crux of this particular question is something that's particularly relevant to our discussion. Because Amir La'akum is something that not only applies to Hilchos Shabbos, it's something that the Gemara says will extend to other areas of Halacha as well. And it really does come up. It does come up in many other contexts in Halacha. It's something we need to think about. And it's something that I think has fascinating implications for many, many very practical shailos that can come up in our experience of life. Any questions?